Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I mean, no one plans to get sick, and yet, here we are. My name is Matthew Zachary. I survived cancer, a stroke, and COVID-19, and somehow, I'm still here. I also survived our stupid broken healthcare system, and I want to help you survive it too. So let's go make healthcare suck less together. Because you know what? We're all out of patience. Hey, that's the name of the show. Hey there, friends. We are off this week, but wanted to bring you a show, and it's a best of show, one of my favorite shows I've ever done, and I mean that, in the history of the 180 plus episodes of Out of Patience that have been produced since February of 2020, and it was with my friend Michelle Ree. The running joke with Michelle is that her parents named her Michelle with one L. So, of course, I just start with that and trigger all sorts of fun stuff in her brain. But she is a young adult cancer survivor whom I met in 2006. But in either case, I talk about a guy named Craig Lustig who introduced me to cancer advocacy. So I introduced her to Craig and he wound up hiring her. So Michelle got her first job in patient advocacy with the guy that literally plucked me out of the matrix and made me the cancer advocate I am today. She has an incredible story to tell. She's funny as all hell. And I think you're going to really like this episode. Again, one of my favorites of all time. We taped it in December of 2020 when the world was absolutely on fire, right before the vaccines got to market. And man, is this show a time capsule. But anyway, it speaks for itself. You're going to love it. Here's Michelle Ree. Oh my God, Michelle, I'm so thrilled to just talk to you in general, but I came to a conclusion that I wanted to share with you. You've been through all sorts of crazy medical shit in your entire life, but the one thing I'm most proud of you for having perseverance in is enduring a life being a Michelle with one L. Talk to us about that.
Being a Michelle with one L, actually, I don't think we've ever talked about how I got that spelling. So this is like the weirdest bit of trivia, but there was this anchor in the New York, New Jersey area when I was born. Her name was Michelle Marsh, and my parents loved her because she was so well-spoken and she held herself so well. And she spelled her name, I think, with one L, and they really liked her. And simultaneously, my parents wanted to give their children American names because they saw their friends give their kids like Korean names and no one could pronounce them. So they wanted to name their kids after like pop culture names that everyone could understand. So I was named after the Beatles song, Michelle My Belle. But they liked that one L, Michelle Marsh. And my dad is a mechanical engineer and he felt that the one L was also more efficient.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I was named Michelle with one L, and then I spent all of that efficiency, all of that time that I saved correcting people on how to spell my name.
No, I mean, the silent H does you in anyway, but one L, you know, that's real fortitude. I commend you for that.
Thank you.
I think it's fair to our listeners who are just walking into this conversation to know who you are. And we have a very, very unique origin story, the two of us.
Oh, we really do.
Yeah. People who listen to my show every now and then hear me keep referring to this mythical guy named Craig. And I keep talking, he's like the linchpin. He's the guy that got me into this whole crazy space. And, you know, this guy, Craig, who the hell is Craig? So Craig was my first peer. He's a guy I met through cancer advocacy. He plucked me out of the ether and said, how'd you like to be an advocate? And I said, what the hell is an advocate? But, you know, he was young. He had brain cancer in his 20s. He was bald. He was from New York City. And he went to my alma mater. We were in the same school together in the same a cappella group years apart. So niche peer support. This guy, Craig, changed my whole life. And when we met, I like, you got to know Craig. I don't know why, but you got to know Craig. And so let's talk about that. Because you got sick when you were 20. You were in college. Like, man, I was 21 in college. We had so much in common. But let's start with that story.
Okay. So when I was 20, I transferred colleges. And before you start a new school, you have to do like the physical to make sure you're okay. And because I was 20, I was still seeing my old pediatrician. And she looked at this like lump on my neck. And she was like, that's new. And I was like, no, that's been there for years. And she was like, but it's gotten bigger. And I was like, yeah, it's fine. And I went, and I was like pretty much healthy, but I went off to school. But she, because I was from a small town, she would call my mom like every day and basically tell my mom she was a bad mother.
Oh,
if
God.
She didn't get me to get that tested. So that's how I ended up getting diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Eventually, months later, over time, it was a much more complicated story. But eventually, over the next year, I got diagnosed with thyroid cancer. I had multiple surgeries, radiation. And then in the follow-up the next year, they scan your lungs because one of the first places that thyroid cancer spreads is to your lungs. And they were like, ooh, there's something there.
You don't want to hear that.
I know. You never want them to kind of make an sound.
Yeah, not okay.
It was a little nerve-wracking. And they were like, but we'll check on in a few months. And they did the test again. They're like, ooh.
Oh, and again, here we are with, interesting.
I know, like terrible. But I eventually had to actually take medical leave because they couldn't figure out what it was. They had to do a lung needle biopsy. I ended up with a collapsed lung. They couldn't figure out what it was. And eventually, they actually had to take a piece out of my lung. So they like kind of chopped in
who to needs me. That?
I know, right? It's just
unnecessary
a small
organs.
And they figured out that it was heart tumor tissue. And so it turned out that I had a benign tumor inside of my heart. So
so what's scarier, a benign tumor or it's in your heart?
I don't know anymore.
You don't have to answer the question. I think it's rhetorical.
I was like, I was seriously considering that. I don't even know anymore. It was so long ago that at this point, I mean, because I still have to get like scans and blood tests to like check for both of them, because the benign tumor, even though it's benign, it can grow back. And I needed to have open heart surgery to have it removed and everything. And it was actually the combination of those two things a benign heart tumor is rare anyway, but the combination of that with the cancer were symptoms of this rare disease that I have, which basically causes me to like have tumors all over the place.
Is there a name for this? Is this like tumoritis or something? I've got tumoritis.
That would be so much easier and connect so much more with what the disease is. But it's named after the guy who discovered it. So it's called Carney complex.
Oh, that's not as fun.
Right? I know. It's not, unless you kind of think of it like a carnival.
It is fun.
Right, exactly. Then it's just a carnival for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. My God, you were the whole package in your 20s. Rare disease, rare cancer, open heart surgery. My God. Yeah.
I was a carnival ride and a half for everyone. And at that time, patient advocacy wasn't a thing. Like, it wasn't a known career or anything like that. And there wasn't support. So I remember, and this is where we're going to age ourselves, but
for sure.
I remember looking up AskJeeves.com.
Oh my God, Ask Jeeves. Look it up, kids.
And I would look for college cancer, teenage cancer, 20s cancer, like trying to find other people. And I remember eventually at some point finding Planet Cancer. So I found Heidi Adams and Planet Cancer that way through like just deep searching on the internet at like 3 a.m.
For the listeners, Planet Cancer was one of the very first websites for young adult cancer founded by our good friend Heidi Adams. We'll put links in the description. It's not there anymore, but it serves such a cultural purpose. And I'm so thrilled because that was the first thing that I found after I met Craig, too.
It was amazing. Like because you didn't meet anyone who had gone through that experience with you. And I had to, in college, like I said, I had to take medical leave. And even when I went back, I needed to have like separate housing because I would be radioactive some parts of the year. And so I needed a separate bathroom.
You ever do the pick up paper clips with your fingers trick?
No, wait, what? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you could fake it by like, if you put a little glue on your fingers and you convince somebody you're radioactive, you're magnetic and pick up paper clips. It's a really great cancer parlor trick.
So the way that my friends and I dealt with it is we were like, wow, because I mean, it was scary to be told that you could poison other people if you use the same utensils. Like it's stuff like that. So we said that my superpower was if people really annoyed my friends, then I could spit in their food and poison them.
You were like so an X-Men. You were X-Men. Exactly. Yes, exactly.
I was radioactive girl.
That's incredible.
And actually, I got like a Superman t-shirt and I would wear it to all of my treatments. And I think I still have that shirt like just packed away. And I don't wear it anymore, but I still have it.
I believe that because you still have like stupid cancer paraphernalia from 15 years ago.
I know. I right before the podcast, I sent you the picture. It's still in my kitchen. And I don't know why I only have that year.
And nothing else. Just that.
And nothing else. But I have the 2011 fridge magnet from stupid cancer.
I remember like I think we met at a Livestrong conference or some type of event. And you were looking for a job, right?
No, actually, I think the way that it happened was...
Don't hurt yourself thinking about this.
Because I think it was when I went to grad school and I needed a summer internship. I think I might have met you before then.
Okay.
And just been like very intimidated because I felt like, because you and Heidi and everyone, like your names were sort of known in the young adult cancer space. And I felt like... I couldn't approach you. Like,
oh,
you
were, God, really?
Yes. Because I was like, oh, they're like famous people.
Cancer famous. Hashtag like cancer famous. Yes.
Cancer famous. But I was going to grad school. I was studying public health policy administration, and I wanted so desperately to work in young adult cancer patient advocacy. And so I remember looking up your like the stupid cancer phone number and cold calling, and I remember being horrified because you picked up.
You expecting like this, you have called the enterprise division of stupid cancer. For the executive division, press 1. For the finance division, press 2. Yeah, it was just me in my bedroom.
I was so horrified. I remember being so taken aback, not knowing what to do. But then I remember kind of stuttering out and trying to explain what I needed and what I wanted. And you were so kind. You were so kind and so generous. And then you made the introduction to Craig Lustig, who at the time was the executive director of Children's Cause for Cancer Advocacy. And they, because you weren't taking interns at the time, and they were. And
I don't think I have an office. You weren't going to come visit me in my house. My second bedroom was the office at the time. Would have been weird. Yeah, I wasn't taking interns.
But I didn't know that in my mind. Were like this, this like godlike figure in the young adult cancer space because, well, you know, like it's, you're so alone and yeah. It felt like you knew everyone and you knew everything. And I just, yeah. So I just remember being so grateful. Well, first horrified that I was speaking with you,
but first then, horrified, then grateful. And then grateful.
And then Craig took me on as an intern. And that was my first like real patient advocacy kind of work experience. And I remember I loved it. It
was addictive,
amazing.
Isn't it?
Oh, it was so addictive, but it was also like heartbreaking. I remember one day literally ending up under my desk because I didn't realize how hard it was going to be emotionally to do that, to be working in my own disease area like every day. And I had to go to Craig's office and have like my little mini breakdown and ask him how he did it. I still to this day don't understand how anyone is strong enough to do that because it's so hard. It's so, so hard to face that every day. Like I work in patient advocacy every day. I work in rare disease and cancer patient advocacy, but I have to be like one step removed from my own because working in my own disease area is, I can't function. I cannot function.
No, I'm so glad you brought that up because, and this is a very sort of crass way to say it, but you have to learn to be a little dead inside to work in your own disease community. Did I just break you? I think I just broke Michelle with one L.
I don't know. I don't really
That's
know
all
how to
for today, folks.
To
join us again next like, week.
The moral of the story is to die a little on the inside.
I said it was a very crass way to say it, but it's really true. I mean, look, we're living our community every day in what we choose to do, and people die and people live, and yeah. Who comes across and like, that could have been me. And yeah, yes, there's a level exactly. of guilt by working in patient advocacy, and that's something that needs to be discussed. And there are a lot of people probably nodding their heads listening to this episode, hearing you reinforce that.
Yes, there's so much survivor's guilt, and there's so much guilt about like which type of cancer you got or which type of rare disease you have or whether there's a treatment for your cancer, whether there's a treatment for your rare disease. Like, there's just so much that I feel, I don't know if I feel guilty about, but I recognize how lucky I am. And I recognize how privileged I have been. I just, in so many ways, their luck has just played a role. Like, I was lucky that my cancer was identified in time, that it hadn't metastasized because it was close. I was lucky that the cancer led to my rare disease diagnosis because if I hadn't had cancer, that tumor, that heart tumor was going to kill me. And it could have killed me, but I was so lucky. And I'm lucky that the rare disease I have is actually the version, the type that I have is treatable with surgeries. But other people have a different like phenotype, a different version of it that isn't treatable that way. I'm just incredibly, incredibly lucky. And I know that. And I've interacted with other people who have either my disease or, you know, some version of it, and they're not as lucky. That's incredibly, incredibly difficult for me to accept as a reality because it's so unfair to see that. And that's the reason I went into patient advocacy because, and drug development in particular, because in my mind, I'm trying to make it so that everyone is as lucky as I am. I want every single person who is diagnosed with cancer or diagnosed with a rare disease to be as lucky as I have been.
Back with our guest after the break.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Let's take this part of the show to talk about where you are now. And my dad, I think you met my dad a few times, the mayor of Stupid Cancer, Lou Greenzweig. But he has this wonderful expression, and it keeps becoming more relevant. And it's that the secret to life is to clean up nice, but never look under the hood. So where are you in the scar wars of beating all this crap 18 years later?
Oh, my gosh. I think that I'm doing really well with the recognition that one day I might realize I'm not doing as well as I thought. I used to joke with my friends that one day I would end up like curled up on the ground in the grocery store, like hugging a head of cauliflower, sobbing or something.
Oh, God. Why cauliflower? Why is it always cauliflower? No, it's not always cauliflower.
Well, so actually, the reason it's cauliflower is when they were trying to describe the heart tumor to me, the doctor was drawing on this white piece of paper and he drew what looked like to me cauliflower.
Oh, God. Okay.
And I couldn't eat it for years. But I just roasted a pan of cauliflower the other day and ate it happily. So, you know.
That's cancer culinary progress triggers.
Exactly. And I mean, there are still certain foods I can't eat because they were the only foods I could eat when I was like having radiation. There are still certain, like the smell of hospital soap. I still can't stand. Like, I can't. It makes me
gag. It's funny how the odors are what still carries forward all these years, right?
I still definitely have certain things, but in terms of overall life, I think that I made certain milestones for myself that I really wanted to hit. And I told myself, like, if I kind of did those things, then I was back to where I was supposed to be, I guess. So because of medical leave, it took me 5 years to graduate college instead of four. And for grad school, I did a joint degree program and I got my two degrees in 3 years instead of four. And so when I graduated, I told myself that I had gotten my year back. And so I was back to where I was. Yeah, exactly. So I told myself I was back to where I was supposed to be. And so I felt like I emotionally kind of accepted that loss of a year that I had in the back of my mind and was able to set that aside and move on.
That was like when they told me I never play piano again and I had two albums 5 years later.
Exactly.
You get that. I want to talk to you about you took this whole advocacy thing and really ran with it. And I don't want to dismiss the whole I got an MBA and an MPH in 3 years thing. That's a big fucking deal. So just to take a moment, listeners, to absorb that she got an MBA, MPH in 3 years. years. Michelle with one L is the real deal. But you spent the past couple of years in like biotech and biopharma. You worked for Bluebird. I love Bluebird. Shout out to Takeda, some company with lots of syllables and vowels. I don't know, ends of a lot, but now you're at X4 Pharmaceuticals. Irrespective of these companies, my question to you is, do they get it? Do they still not get it? What patients are, what they do, and what it's like?
I love that question because I don't think it's the right question.
Ooh. Go on.
Because you're treating everyone like it's a monolith. You're treating biotech and pharma like they are one being, and they are not. Because what I have found universally at every company that I've worked at is that every single person wants to help patients. I haven't met a single person who doesn't want to help patients and who doesn't have like some type of personal connection to someone somewhere, you know? And it's just a question of the methodology and what their previous experience has been and how open they are. And so the question isn't like if they get it or don't get it. It's a question of where are they now and how do we get them to, well, where I think they should be or where you think they should be.
Right. I mean, I have stories of these go-to-market strategies on patient gene therapies, and they never talk to the community before launching the drug, and then no one wants it. So, I mean, you could laugh your ass off on that, which I am doing right now inside myself. But at the same time, where is the gap? Yes, everyone's a patient. You can't not know somebody that hasn't gone through some crazy crap. I look at the gaps in appreciating that healthcare, and I said this ad nauseum, cancer care, rare disease care is a supply-only economy. And the consumer slash patient isn't the end user when it's really the payer and the prescriber. So how do you square the circle on that ecosystem of purchase power and demand market? I'm using big words in like an economic sense, like I have some kind of degree. But, you know, you and I live in the space of, you know, you enter a shit happens store, you don't know where to shop and who's going to help you. And these companies may have the most groundbreaking Star Trek level shit to go to market. But if you don't know it exists, your doctor doesn't think it's right for you, and you can't get it or pay for it. That's been the narrative for 20 years.
And I think that's an interesting way to think about it also, because when you think about 20 years ago, the laws and regulations were different. And so the way that like the healthcare system was set up, the way that the laws were about whether companies could talk with doctors or talk with patients about informed consent in research, like everything was so different. And the way that systems were set up were so different. And I think a lot of the just like the habits that people got into were not necessarily bad habits. Well, OK, they're kind of bad habits, but they got right into the habit of thinking that, you know, doctors made the decisions about healthcare for a patient. And they got into the habit of thinking that doctors could give you the meta view of what patients were thinking and feeling because they saw multiple patients instead of going to patients directly and asking them what they were thinking and feeling. And it was because there were, you know, different rules around what you could and couldn't do, how you could and couldn't interact. And exactly what you were saying in terms of who the actual purchasers are, in terms of like how our system is set up, it's so completely convoluted. And it's one of those situations where you really have to ask the question of, are you actually getting value here? Is there true value? Because it's only when at least from my perspective, I think that, you know, you really have to look at like, is this something that we need? Is this something that's adding value for everyone? Like, because if it really is something, and this is where I love working, especially in rare diseases, because the majority, over 95% of rare diseases don't have an FDA approved therapy. And so when you're working to develop therapies for communities that don't have anything approved, then you know that you're actually working to develop something that means something and that will make a difference. That's actually addressing a need. And when you're doing that, then you know that it actually matters. And then it's a question of how you do it. You are addressing a need, then how are you doing it? And for me, at least, I've been lucky enough that I've been able to make choices about where I work. And certainly, like, the people that I work with get it. And I choose to work with people who I think really get it, and allow me to build an infrastructure and build a model where we're incorporating that patient perspective into the decision making, so that not only are we working towards something that patients really care about, we're doing it in a way that patients really respect and that patients would be proud to see.
Can you point to one specific case study that you're most proud of in your work?
Ooh, that's like picking a favorite child.
Humor me. Pick one. It's the boy. It's the girl. It's the older one. Whatever.
I would say one of the things that I'm proudest of is an engagement I had with the complete DeGeorge or congenital athymia patient community when I was working at Enzivant, because they, first, they're just an amazing community. I love them so much. And they don't have an official patient advocacy group. They don't have a 501c3. They haven't filed. And I think what I've heard from other companies, I didn't hear it from Enzivant, but what I've heard from other companies is they want to help a community form a 501c3. They want to help them form a patient advocacy group. And that's not the job of a company at all. If a community wants to form a 501c3, then the company can support that appropriately and compliantly. But it's not the job of a company to do that. And I was given the space and the leeway to engage with the community in a really positive way, and instead to provide them the support that they needed to have the conversation amongst themselves and with support from Global Genes, which is an umbrella rare disease organization, around what is it that they needed as a community? What did they need to provide for themselves, to support themselves? Or were they things that they couldn't provide for themselves? And then trying to figure out, you know, did they want to stay just as a Facebook group? Was that enough for them? Or did they want to go under the umbrella of another organization who could provide some more of that infrastructure that they couldn't provide for themselves? Or were they really at a point where they wanted to form their own group, which is a huge undertaking? And that, obviously, like, we as a company, we're not going to be involved in that at all, but we could help support them to give them time to do that. And being able to provide the support to the community to allow them to do that and to have that time to think and to make that decision is something I'm incredibly proud of.
I approve this message. That's extraordinary, really extraordinary. So I want to talk about giving back. Going back to our therapy session of it's really hard to work in our own space, it can be extraordinarily rewarding. And I want to take a moment to recognize an organization that my listeners may or may not know of, the SAM Fund,
yes,
founded by our friend Samantha Eisenstein, another one of the original rapscallions in the early Livestrong Young Adult Cancer Movement Day. I don't know if you knew this, but I was on one of her review committees for a year, and
no,
that was heart-wrenching. So for the listeners, the SAM Fund grants micro scholarships to young adult cancer survivors in the form of paying their gym membership or their rent or their car payments when there's so much financial insecurity going through treatment. A truly noble organization. And you volunteered there, and I think you still are. What do they call you? Like Samsonites or Sam Awesomes? I don't know. What are you?
I think we were called Sambassadors.
Sambassador.
I don't know if they actually use that term anymore, but
okay.
I loved that term so much, Sambassador.
It's true. So I want help our listeners understand what it's like to go from you're dying, heart surgery, to now I'm here, I'm you know, 18 years out of this hot mess, you know, and which, by the way, in Jewish is like, it means life. 18 means life in Jewish. So it's a good year to be you from this Jew's perspective. But giving back, this idea of paying it forward, not through a career, but through volunteership. Talk to us about that.
I hadn't quite thought of it that way, I think, but yes, yeah, absolutely. I adore the SAM funds and their mission. And so it seems like just a natural thing to do to support them and their work. I actually was originally, I think it was their second year in existence, I was a SAM Fund grant recipient.
Oh, wow.
And it was when I was in graduate school. And at that point, my parents had spent, because I'd always been under my parents' insurance, they had spent, I can't tell you how much money on all of my medical treatments. And I was not willing to ask them for any money at all for grad school, for anything. And so I had, you know, been budgeting everything out, and I realized that I needed a new laptop and I needed business clothes for business school and interviews. And I applied to the SAM Fund and explained, like, you know, I'm going to be in business school with all of these like investment banking finance people.
Right.
I am going to be coming from this like cancer, I was a study coordinator like background. I don't know all of this stuff. I already feel like I don't necessarily fit in. And I have this like really junky laptop. I don't have business clothes. And I cannot ask my parents for more money. And they helped me get a new laptop, and they helped me get business clothes so that I felt like I could fit in with.
And that's what the SAM Fund did. See, that made all the difference to you. And this speaks to, you know, our passion about survivorship and quality of life. And the, I think Livestrong pioneered the practical issues of dealing with shit happens. And man, I was so privileged to know Sam and work with her. And I don't think I was on the committee the year you received it, but I have such a level of passion and empathy and triggers, because that could be me, or maybe that was me. And I'm so blessed to have you on this show, and I'm so happy. Hey, look at us, hashtag how the hell are we still here? But we're doing our thing, and you are a stellar example of what it means to be an advocate. And I'd love to have you back. You have so much to contribute to the conversations. Michelle Rhee is currently the Vice President of Patient Affairs and Advocacy. I'm going to also add Chief Badass Officer at X4 Pharmaceuticals, young adult survivor of thyroid cancer and benign heart tumor. Like, those words shouldn't go together in the first place. But thank you so much for coming on the show. And I hope everyone listening learned a little bit today about dealing with shit happens.
Thank you.
That's all for now. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. Tell us what you'd like Matthew to cover in his next episode by leaving a message for us at 855-AUDIO-66, and we might just use it in a future show. Out of Patients is a product of Offscript Health. We are a healthcare engagement company built for patients and caregivers by patients and caregivers. Our executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Our senior producer is Betsy Shepherd. Our host is Matthew Zachary. It is recorded, mixed, and edited by Betsy Shepherd. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscriptnot.com. That's media@offscript.com. For more information, visit offscript.com.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.